little bit late, but that's all right. We're on item number 9, which is the WDFW research priorities, and this is a briefing. And I see we're being briefed by a whole bunch of good folks, so I will turn it over.
Give them an hour.
Good afternoon, Chairman Smith, members of the commission, and Director Unsworth. My name is Eric Netherland, and I'm the science director in the FISH program. And today, we're going to talk to you about science across the agency. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about this research. This was a request by the commission, and we thought we'd just try and give you a good overview of what we're doing. So I'm just going to go through a couple of slides here, and then I'll just turn it over to the researchers. And our idea here was to try and give you a little bit of an overview, but we thought it'd be really useful to just look at some of the stuff we're doing in a little bit of detail. So we're going to just jump into some selected projects. These aren't necessarily our top priorities, but they're just work that we're doing that provides an overview of the diversity of work we do. The other thing we thought we would do is just give you an opportunity to meet the actual researchers that are doing the work. And so you'll meet those as we go through those folks as we go through the presentations. And the way we have it structured is each program will do a 15 to 20 minute presentation. There'll be time for questions, like a question or two as we transition. And then at the end of all the talks, there'll also be some time left for questions. So just keep that in mind.
And just up front, I mean, time is going to be a limiting factor.
Yes, so yes.
Appreciate that.
We will do our, we will stay on time. We've been working on that. So just as a reminder, hallmarks of the science that we do in DFW, one is it's very specific and adaptive. And so unlike maybe university research or federal research, the reason we're doing science is because we have hard questions, whether it be management or policy issues. And I think as we go through the talks today, you'll see that emerge as a theme. The other thing, just like as an agency, we deal with a wide breadth of issues. Our science reflects the diversity of stuff that we work on and the questions that we try and address, so you'll see that today. And then finally, our work is cooperative. One, that's the nature of science, but in today's world, it's necessary. If we are not cooperative and we're not working with our partners, we are not going to do the quality science that we need, and we're not going to get the funding that's required. And so you'll see, also reflected in today's talks, that the work we do, we're cooperating with our partners, our tribal co-managers, federal agencies, universities, and you'll see that reflected. So that's my part. So without further ado, I will introduce Scott Pearson, who's the senior researcher in wildlife program. He'll take over. And then as we go through the talks, I'll just let the other researchers introduce themselves. So thank you.
Good afternoon. So I'm going to talk a bit today about monitoring that we do and how when we do monitoring in a research and management framework, how it leads to hopefully better conservation. And I'm going to use two examples from my own research, and I could have brought in a lot of different examples, including game species, other non-game species, et cetera. These are just two examples. And then hopefully it will emphasize how we work with partners, how we inform management, how it results in adaptive management, and then hopefully it also shows you how we try to make the most information that we gain. And let me start with the western snowy plover. This is a shorebird found on the coast of Washington. It's listed as threatened by the state of Washington. It's also listed federally as a threatened species. It breeds from Baja California all the way up here to Washington, and it's a small shorebird. It's found in specific habitat types along the coast. So there are places where you find it and places where you don't. And so where do those occur in Washington? Well, they're the sandy coastline, primarily just north of Ocean Shores, Copalis, Conner Creek area is where they used to be found and are no longer found. Also the Damon Point area, another place where they used to be found and are no longer found. And then as you go down to Midway Grayland Beach, where they still exist, and then you can go around the corner to the Shoalwater Indian Reservation, where they still exist, and then down at the tip of the Long Beach Peninsula at Ledbetter Point on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuge there. And we've been monitoring three primarily variables, nest success, fledging success, and breeding adult population size. And we've been doing this since the 1990s, And we've been doing this with a lot of different partners. Our federal partners, who are the primary funders of this work, we work with the local tribe, we work with people south of the border in Oregon so that we're monitoring the birds in the exact same way and we can combine our data, and also work with local land managers like the state parks. So the first question we can look at with some of our monitoring data is habitat restoration effective? And when people go out to the coast of Washington, particularly around ocean shores, you see this vast area of grasses. And people think that's what it should look like. And historically, it's not what it used to look like. Those grasses were introduced, they were introduced to stabilize sand dunes, and they were very effective at that. We introduced two different species. We introduced European beech grass, and then we also introduced American beech grass from the Great Lakes and eastern United States. This resulted in the loss of that sparsely vegetated habitat, which is preferred by some species like the western snowy plover. So the question is, if you try to restore that habitat, you try to remove some of that beech grass and go back to that sparsely vegetated condition, does it result in benefiting the plovers? And so here's an aerial photo at the tip of Long Beach Peninsula at Leadbetter. And there are three different bulldozers. You can see as little dots in this picture. They're really hard to see. They're right here. Just to give you an idea of scale, this is now over 500 acres in size. The beech grass has been bulldozed by the refuge and creating that sparsely vegetated habitat like you see here. And this is what some of it looks like today. And the question is, did we replicate what it used to look like? And if you look what it looked like 50 years ago, pictures taken from the same place, this is what it looked like 50 years ago. And so you can see they did a pretty good job of mimicking that swale and hummock topography of the coast. As I said, it's very large in size, over 500 acres. So if we build it, did they come? And so if you look at that habitat restoration area and look at its growth over time in acres, that top line, and then look at how the plover responded, that lower line, the blue line, you can see, well, they moved into it. So they moved from the outer beach into the restoration area, but then the population didn't grow. And that suggests that the species is not habitat limited necessarily. So what might be limiting the species? Well, remember that other metric I said we were monitoring was reproductive success or nest success. And we found that the primary source of nest failure for the species is predation, and primarily by ravens and crows. And there are a lot of ways we can deal with predation. All of these techniques have been used for western snowy plovers throughout the range between California and here. We've tried most of these techniques on this list. And let me just talk about a few that we've worked with. One is placing cages around nests, these enclosures. These are about a meter in size, about this size. They have openings about this big, so the plover can walk in and out. Cindy Sundstrom, who's the biologist doing most of the monitoring out of the region for this species, can set up this cage in about 10 minutes. And about 10 minutes later, the plover is back inside that cage and is incubating its eggs. And so the question is, are they effective? Did they help reduce predation? So we can monitor exclosed and unexclosed nests, so we can look at the reproductive success of plovers. It's a complicated slide, and all you need to look at here is that are the solid lines above the dashed lines, and they are. So that's the exclosures were more effective than the in preventing predation than the unexclosed nests. And how does that translate? That translates to about a 10% reproductive success or nest success for the plover to what we see in exclosures, which is as high as 70% when you're using an exclosure. So it worked. But at the same time, there are problems with exclosures. Sometimes the predators have come in and will key in on these exclosures or use them as perches and then eat the plovers inside of them. The other thing we found is that even though we were getting higher hatching success, the chicks, after they hatch, within hours, they're out running around on the beach. And you can see some pictures of chicks here. And so they're precocial. And for the next 28 days, they rely on their father. And they're going around on the beach with their father. Initially, the dad's responsible for helping them thermoregulate, but also helps take them to areas where there's food supplies and also keeps them away from predators. But we found is that even though we were getting those chicks out of the nests, they were then being eaten as chicks. So we weren't having a net benefit on the population as a result of exclosures. And without our monitoring, we wouldn't have known that. So the management would not have truly been effective. So then the question was, well, can we do something else? And we looked at predator management. And Oregon was doing this, and so we took advantage of Oregon doing this to the south of us and combined our data with them. and looked at, okay, well, if you're doing predator management, which means a variety of things, you're actually killing predators, you're harassing predators, you're trapping and removing predators. Does it actually benefit the plover? And we found it did. It actually allowed those chicks to survive better. And then we started doing that here. And ultimately, you really want to know, is there a net population benefit to the population? Does it go up eventually? And so I said we were monitoring that population consistently since 2006. It was going down all the way through 2012. And about the time we started predator management, we started to see this uptick in this population. And now we have unusually high numbers. This past year, we actually had over 90 birds. And we were down to as low as 30 birds in the state of Washington. So went up from 30 to 90, a pretty big jump. And I can't say that's all due to our work. Oregon's doing some of the same work, and we're getting some spillover effect from Oregon as well. So I want to just quickly change gears and talk about how we try to gain as much information from our monitoring efforts and talk a little bit about some of our marble murrelet at sea monitoring work. This is a small seabird. Spends most of its life in marine waters, but it's an odd seabird in that it comes inland and nests on trees. We've been monitoring it consistently, actually started doing it in the 1990s, but consistently monitoring it since the year 2000. And it's the only way we can estimate population size and trends for this species is the at-sea work. It's not done through forest work. And we do this with a variety of partners. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ends up funding us to do the work. And remember, that primary goal is to assess how many are there out there and what are their trends. And we report on that every year, and so we get graphs like this, and we show people how it's doing. And in general, it's been declining, and particularly in the Puget Sound in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, it's been declining more than on the outer coast. The outer coast, we don't have a significant trend, but we have a significant trend in the Salish Sea. Okay, so that's important information. It tells us, are we achieving recovery or not for this species? But there's really a lot more we can gain out of this information, a whole list of things. I don't want you to read all this, but it's a long list of things we can start to gain out of this type of research. And we can identify where do we see a lot of these birds and where do we see them consistently. So we can combine our data with folks' work being done in Oregon and California, identify these hot spots, these high-density places. In Washington, those hot spots are in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, Admiralty Inlet, and also in the San Juan Islands. We can start to look at what factors might be driving the change in distribution and abundance. Is it things going on in the ocean, or is it things going on in the forest? So you can look both ways and look at the factors that might be influencing the change in distribution and abundance through a modeling exercise we did. And we found that actually the nesting habitat had the greatest amount of influence, particularly on the coast of Washington, whereas the foraging habitat had less of an impact on the change in distribution and abundance. But if we look at the Salish Sea, we see those two things reversed. It's actually the foraging habitat. The things going on in the marine environment seems to have a bigger effect than things going on in the nesting habitat. So it changes spatially. And as we're out there monitoring murrelets, we might as well monitor a lot of other species because we're spending all that money. And so every species, as we're going down on that boat on a transect, we record. And so we can get information on things like tufted puffins. And as you know, we were just recently listed this species. That's the information we provided to our diversity division. And it's based partially on the information that we provide that ultimately resulted in the listing of the species at the state level. We can also combine our information with other people doing surveys to identify where do we have high densities of this species and where do we have low density. You find it high density near the colonies on the northern coast, but also there's this hot spot of foraging further out beyond the shelf break where they spend time foraging. And then we can look at a variety of other species. I'm going to skip over a couple here just to save some time and just talk a little bit about some of the Puget Sound Partnership is using some of our information in their what they call their list of vital signs and whether or not they're achieving recovery of Puget Sound. And they look at a lot of different vital signs from the human population, human quality of life, water quality and quantity, nearshore habitat, and species and food webs. And our agency informs primarily those bottom two sections of the pie. Our habitat program helps inform that habitat part, and our fish and wildlife programs help inform the species and food web sections of that pie. And then our monitoring on the seabirds goes into that bird indicator, both the work that we do in the summer as well as the work that we do in the winter. And then finally, we can use the information that we gain in marine spatial planning for the outer coast. This is an effort being led by Ecology, but also DNR, where we're starting to compile a lot of different information and work with our partners at NOAA. We can overlay a lot of information, whether it's the distribution of murrelets off the coast, or the tufted puffin, which I just showed you a minute ago, or a humpback whale, or Dahl's porpoise. And so I can now start to overlay all this information. I can look at where we might want to put alternative energy projects. I can look where human uses that we care about are occurring, whether it's fishing or crabbing or whatever. And we can start to look at the intersection of all these things and then help us inform where, if we were going to put an alternative energy site, where would we put it? So with that, I just want to sum up that we work with a lot of different partners. We try to do our work in a management and research context. We try to do adaptive management where we can and make the most of our information. And if I have a minute for questions, I'll take... Do I have a minute?
7.5.
You have one question.
One question.
Any questions? Yes.
So one of the factors in small populations like the snowy plover that could cause a decline in biologic genetic, lack of genetic diversity, and I didn't see that as part of the questions that you were researching.
Well, there are a lot of other questions that we are researching with the, with that species. We have looked at the genetics. Unfortunately, there's a lot of interchange across the...
Well, actually, that's good, probably.
Yeah, which is a really good thing. Some of our birds have moved all the way down to Southern California.
Okay.
And some of the Southern California, well, rarely. We mostly get birds from Northern California and from Oregon moving into our world. And so there is actually, fortunately, a very nice interchange.
Okay.
And there's not evidence of a bottleneck.
Thank you.
Dr. Pearson, that was really good. Very interesting. Thank you, commissioners, for inviting us here today. My name is George Wilhair. I'm a senior research scientist in the Habitat program. I was directed to keep this light and fun, so let's see how this goes. As you know, one of the most important duties of the Habitat program is to maintain fish passage through all culverts in Washington State. I'm going to tell you about research in engineering and science that is helping to usher in a golden age of culverts. This culvert was built about 1,900 years ago by the Roman Empire in what is now Dorset, England. It still functions as a water crossing structure for cars and trucks. Following the decline of the Roman Empire was the Dark Ages. And from a fish perspective, the Dark Ages for about 2,000 years. And during this time, the needs of fish in culvert design have been ignored, were considered unimportant, or just avoided altogether. And when the needs of fish were recognized, they were dealt with rather crudely. As a result, in Washington State, we have thousands, many thousands of culverts that are currently blocking fish passage in rivers and streams. However, slowly but surely, we are leaving the Dark Ages and entering a golden age of culverts. Centuries from now, when culvert historians look back upon the early 21st century, they will point to the invention of the stream simulation culvert as the beginning of a golden age. The stream simulation culvert is based on a very simple idea. If fish can swim through the natural channel, they should also be able to swim through an artificial channel that closely simulates the natural channel. So after 2,000 years of culvert design and construction, we finally have a culvert design that explicitly addresses the needs of all fish species at all life stages. And guess what? It was invented by engineers in the Habitat program. The Transportation Research Record is a publication of the National Academy of Engineering. Here's a quote from this publication in 2011. The concept of stream simulation was first introduced by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife in 1999, something we can all be proud of. The stream simulation concept has been adopted by departments of transportation throughout the nation. For example, Alaska, California, it's a long list. I have to actually read it. Alaska, California, New York, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Hampshire, and Georgia all use stream simulation design in culverts. The U.S. Forest Service and the Federal Highways Administration also use stream simulation design. There's no doubt that engineers in the Habitat program have had a major impact on fish conservation in the United States. But there's more. Scientists and engineers in the Habitat program continue to be national leaders in the design and in culvert design and research. The stream simulation culvert is mostly based on theory, and WDFW is one of the few organizations currently doing empirical research to test that theory. Bob Barnard, an engineer in the Habitat program, and three colleagues from WDFW evaluated stream simulation culverts by comparing stream beds inside the culverts to stream beds outside the culverts. The photos show one of the 50 sites included in the study. This study was published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal in 2015, and it is the only study in the peer-reviewed literature on the capacity of stream simulation culverts to actually simulate streams. Barnard's study made only one visit to each culvert. It was a snapshot in time. But as you can see here, culverts that look fine in 1 year can be a complete blockage to fish just a few years later. So clearly, to understand culvert performance, we need long-term monitoring, and that's what we're doing. For the past 4 years, we have been monitoring culverts immediately after their construction, and then we visit them in years 1, 2, 5, and 10. We place 3 transects above the culvert and 3 transects below the culvert. The graphs here show two such cross-sections. The blue lines were recorded in year 1, and the red lines in year 2. The space between the two lines is the amount of change that has occurred in fish habitat during that 1 year. With these measurements, we can track changes in time. Large changes in channel profile indicate potential problems with the culvert that could lead to fish passage barriers. With this information, we can analyze culverts in fish habitat and improve culvert designs over time. We do only 6 cross-sections at each culvert because the measurements are time-consuming. We have a lot of culverts to measure, and we only have a small staff to do it. This compromise on data collection may hinder our ability to understand culverts and their interactions with fish habitat. One of the tools we're exploring to address this potential problem is data collection and modeling technique known as Structure from Motion, or SFM. With an ordinary digital camera and highly sophisticated computer software, we have created 3-dimensional representations of culverts and fish habitat. This image that you're seeing here looks straight down on a culvert in the adjacent stream channel. The narrowest part of the culvert, the narrowest part of the image is the culvert. The 3D image is rotating so that we can look into the downstream end of the culvert. As we zoom in, you can see details of fish habitat structure, the shape of the channel, boulders, cobble, and even gravel. We can see inside the culvert. And under the right conditions, this technique can even see, if you will, through water to the stream bed. All this is stored as numerical data that can be used to analyze the effects of culvert on fish habitat structure. Instead of only 6 transects, which we did before, per culvert, SFM is equivalent to doing hundreds of transects per culvert in about the same amount of time. Another cool project we plan to begin this January uses high-powered computer simulations to analyze culverts. We use computer simulations for 3 reasons. One, field research is very expensive. With computer simulations, we can collect less data and reduce those costs. Second, we're concerned about culvert interactions with extreme events, but monitoring may not coincide in time with extreme events. So, for instance, 100-year floods are supposed to happen on average only about once every 100 years. And third, we know our current culvert designs could be better, but constructing new culverts for the purposes of research is entirely impractical. These figures were produced by a research group at Brigham Young University. They show where sediment is deposited during different stream flows in a culvert and the adjacent stream channel. With similar computer software, we will answer some of our own questions about how culverts interact with fish habitat. The last research effort I'll cover today is a collaboration with the University of Washington that was funded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are obvious causal links shown here between climate change and channel width. Climate experts at the University of Washington project that winter stream flows in many watersheds will be much larger than they are today. Hence, climate change could cause more frequent culvert failures, such as the one shown here. Furthermore, stream flows affect channel width. Channel width determines culvert width, and culvert width affects fish passage. Therefore, the Habitat program is very concerned about climate change. Before this project, scientists already knew about these causal linkages. What we haven't known until now is how much channel width might change due to future climate change. The results of this collaboration with the University of Washington is the map that shows how projected, the map that shows projected future change in channel width across Washington. This information can be used by engineers to adjust the dimensions of new culverts so that they can accommodate future changes in channel width, and therefore are more likely to provide fish passage over the entire service life of the culvert, which typically lasts between 50 and 100 years. There's a lot of interest in this research. In May of this year, the project sponsor, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, organized a webinar for us to present our results to a nationwide audience. They reserved 200 ports for this seminar or this webinar, but the demand for a presentation far exceeded the number of ports that they had reserved. They told us this was the first time this had ever happened to them. We're really proud of that. Some engineers are already using the results of our research. A lot of fish habitat restoration is currently occurring in the Chehalis Basin. A lot of that research, a lot of that restoration involves replacing culverts that block fish. Through a fortuitous set of circumstances, we're able to work with project proponents in the Chehalis Basin. This map shows about 30 of their projects, and we know that at least 20 of those projects are already using our projections and culvert in a channel width to adapt their culverts to climate change. The Habitat Program has made significant contributions to fish conservation through innovative culvert design and research. Scientists and engineers in the Habitat Program are excited about future research and using that to make culverts more passable for fish. The golden age of culverts is just beginning, and in the golden age, eventually all culverts will allow all fish species at all life stages to move freely through streams throughout Washington. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the golden age?
Yeah, switch. No questions for culverts? Most important thing we do for habitat restoration.
I'm Philip Dion, research scientist with the Habitat Program, and George talked to you a little bit about the work that we do in freshwater habitat, and I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about one project in particular that we're doing in marine habitat. But before I do, I want to acknowledge a lot of the support that we've had from different groups on the screen here that support us in various ways, but in particular I want to acknowledge USGS, Evergreen State College, Point Defiant Zoo Aquarium, Department of Natural Resources, and the Washington Conservation Corps for their help on this particular project. And I really want to highlight the Washington Conservation Corps. We've been really fortunate for the past 3 years to work with a group of young adults and veterans to help us do this type of work, and have been really happy to work with them. They've been an asset to our program. And also the project I'm going to talk about has been done in close partnership with the fish program, and I realize that you're going to have a briefing about forage fish this afternoon, so that's why I only selected one of our partnership projects to talk about, just a pilot study that we did on tagging surf smelt. So Habitat Program is interested in forage fish habitat and nearshore habitat because it's actually where the forage fish choose to spawn in some cases. This is what a typical beach for surf smelt spawning looks like. In this magnifying image is the surf smelt eggs. So these are about a millimeter in diameter. And prior to the construction of that bulkhead, that would have been forage fish habitat. And so we have an interest in documenting the location of this habitat. And so we've been doing that for about 40 years by surveying beaches, actually collecting sand and gravel and looking through a microscope to see if we can identify where these eggs exist. And that's where most of our surf smelt information comes from, and most of what we know about surf smelt is based on where we find their eggs and when we find them there. So we have a pretty large knowledge gap with regards to what the adults are doing, where they're moving, how frequently they're visiting some of these beaches. So the study that I'm going to talk about today is an attempt to see whether or not we can use a new technique, try tagging these fish to learn about some of these knowledge gaps or fill these gaps in. So we had a pretty simple study. Again, this was a pilot study that we did with working with the Washington Conservation Corps and Fish Program and several other groups. And our first question was pretty straightforward. Can we mark surf smelt without killing them? So if you're not familiar with mark recapture studies, there's two parts to it. There's a mark and a recapture. And if you kill all of your fish, you don't get a recapture part. So we had to make sure that we would have an opportunity to recapture these fish. So we did this with a holding trial at the Point Defiant Zoo Aquarium. Assuming that we could mark these fish without killing them, our next question was, can we put them out into the wild and actually recover them? So forage fish aren't typically considered to be an ideal candidate for a mark recapture study because, as their name implies, they are forage for other species and generally get eaten. And so as a short-lived species, you generally assume you'll have to tag a lot of fish before you have any chance of getting them back. So that was also a big question. And so we did this with an actual field trial where we marked fish in the wild and released them. And then our final question was, if we are successful at marking and releasing fish and recapturing them, then what can we learn about the species and their movements? Can we actually fill some of these knowledge gaps with this approach? So to do the study, we selected a what's called a visible implant elastomer tag, or a VIE tag. And this is a tag that is essentially like a two-part epoxy that is injected under the skin like a tattoo, and it cures into a flexible rubber material. And it's actually fluoresces under UV light, so it's very visible. And we selected it because it was low cost, minimally invasive, easy to use, and also non-toxic, which is important for the species because it is both commercially and recreationally harvested. So we had to make sure we're using a tag that wasn't going to be harmful if ingested. So for our holding trial, we had 119 smelt that we held for 3 weeks at the Point Defiant Zoo Aquarium. And our tag retention rate was 100%, which we were very pleased with, and we had a survival rate of 92%, which in an artificial environment we thought was acceptable to carry on with our field study, even though we didn't actually insert predators into the environment. We aren't sure what the outcome would be for natural survival, and so that's why we proceeded to our field trial. So for our field trial, we selected two beaches here in South Puget Sound. If you're familiar with the area, this is Eld Inlet. This is the Evergreen Beach here on the right-hand side, and then across the way is Sunrise Beach, and we're right here in Olympia. And we selected these beaches because they are well-documented surf smelt spawning beaches, and also they're right in our backyard, so we were able to access them readily. We also had a good partnership with the landowners in both of these areas, so they're allowing us to come back to the beach on a monthly basis to do these surveys. And we had a very simple study plan. Step one, catch smelt. We did this by using beach seines off of both of those beaches. And we would survey one beach one day with several beach seine sets and mark all the fish that we captured and release them, and then we would proceed to the next beach the following day. Step two was to tag with site and date specific marks. So to do this, we had four different tag colors, and we identified four different locations on the smelt body that could be marked and identified. And so by combining different parts of the body and colors, we were able to come up with a date and site specific mark for each batch of fish that we collected. Step three was to record biological data, which included the sex or spawning condition and the length. And for the spawning condition, these are, as I mentioned earlier, these are beach spawning fish. And we discovered pretty quickly that the majority of the fish that we encountered were ripe and running. So they were easily expressing eggs and milt. And we believe that these fish were in the vicinity of the beach and available for us to capture because they were preparing to spawn. So very close to their spawning event. Step four was to release the marked smelt alive. As I mentioned previously, if you kill all your smelt before you release them, your recapture part of the study is a failure. So we were very successful at this, we believe. We had pretty good recovery rates. Most of the fish swam away readily after being marked, and our marking procedure is very quick. Generally, the fish were handled for less than 30 seconds. And finally, we did this every month at both beaches for 15 consecutive months. So the results were, first of all, you'll notice on the number of fish that we captured, there was a pretty strong bias towards males in the sex ratio, roughly a 4-to-1 male to female sex ratio. And I also want to point out that the number of unknown fish was pretty small, and the majority of those unknown fish that we couldn't identify sex were from a single capture event where we captured a large group of juveniles that we did not encounter again. But otherwise, most of the fish that we handled, we were able to identify the sex of. And this figure here, what this is illustrating is on the left, we have the number of fish recaptured. And then this is on the x-axis, the number of months post-marking that the fish was recaptured. So 1 month would indicate that it had been 1 month after the initial capture. Zero indicates that that fish was actually recaptured within the same month that we had initially tagged it. And so to answer our second question, could we successfully mark and recapture these fish? The answer is yes. We actually successfully recaptured 70 fish, which if you don't need to be a statistician to know that that's less than 1%, which isn't really a great number to come up with any sort of abundance estimate, which wasn't the goal of the study, but we do think we did learn some rather interesting things from this study. So first of all, we learned that within a month, first thing that we learned is that these fish are actually relatively hardy and the tags are relatively persistent. We recaptured fish up to 9 months after initially tagging them. And we also learned from that that these fish will return to the same spawning beaches 9 months after initially being tagged. And since most of these fish were in spawning condition, they're utilizing some of those same spawning beaches at least 9 months out from initial tagging. We also noticed that most of our fish were recaptured within the same month. So that means that they were captured on one beach and then recaptured the following day on a different beach. And this was very interesting to us because this indicates that these spawning groups are actually using multiple spawning beaches over a single spawning event. And they may be batch spawning, so spawning multiple times within a spawning period. So very interesting, especially from a habitat perspective, to know that they're not only using one beach as a spawning beach. We also found it very interesting that we never recaptured a fish the month following that is initially tagged. Normally, for mark recapture studies, you would expect to have a big spike the following month. And what we've interpreted this as is actually this is the recovery period between spawning events. So you'll notice that in month two, we had our peak in males. So we suspect that males likely need at least a 1 month recovery period between spawning events. So they are multiple spawners and can go back and spawn multiple times. And at the same time, we noticed that there were no females in that second month, but by month three, we started seeing females, so we suspect that females with their greater energy contribution to gonad development likely need a longer period of recovery. So we have a 2 to 3 month recovery period for females. And this likely helps to explain that sex ratio that I mentioned earlier with the 4 to 1 males to females. It appears that males are available to spawn, so spawning more regularly, and so we'll see males more frequently on the beach. So in summary, we learned that surf smelt are hardy and will likely spawn on the same beaches for at least 9 months. Multiple surf smelt will spawn on multiple beaches multiple times. And that the differential spawning frequency that we've observed may explain the male bias sex ratios that we've observed. So what's next? As with any good pilot study, more questions. First of all, what happened to the other 9,927 fish that we didn't recapture? And the answer is we don't know. We've got some theories, but we would need to do some more tagging or use different techniques to really hammer out those questions. But there are some other questions that we're starting to move on. One of them is, can we enhance our creel surveys by combining them with some tagging methods? And this is something that we'd like to try next year, is working on some of the more popular commercial and recreational harvest beaches and tagging large groups of fish in those areas and then having creel samplers check for those tags and so that we can begin to understand our exploitation rate on these fish. And finally, can we learn more about other Puget Sound species using similar methods? And we've actually already made progress on this. So we've moved ahead. We've worked with Washington State University at the Friday Harbor Marine Labs. And on the left here, this is actually juvenile sand lance that we've been able to tag using these same methods. And they're actually being exposed to the UV light right now. That's why they're glowing in the dark. And the students at Friday Harbor Marine Lab have been tagging these sand lance as part of a study on sand lance that they're doing out of the labs. And then on the right is actually what we consider to be a bycatch of this study. This is a cutthroat trout that we found in relatively high abundance in the same areas that we are tagging for surf smelt, probably because they are also feeding on the surf smelt. And this particular individual was recaptured 5 times on the same site, so we're learning something about the movements and site fidelity of the cutthroat as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions on the little critters?
All right. Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Mara Zimmerman. I'm a research scientist in the fish program. And so I will be talking or continuing our presentation this afternoon by talking about science activities within the fish program. Our science staff work in the field studying fish populations across the state. We also have a molecular genetics lab, a fish health lab, and a scale aging lab here in Olympia. As well, we have a data management team that manages massive amounts of information that we collect on the numbers of fish, the catch in our fisheries, the locations of fish across the state. We work collaboratively amongst each other and with our management staff with the aim of using science to affect change and increase conservation, recovery, and fishing opportunities. We think about this in terms of several different approaches. One is to think about the current management needs within the agency. We think about emerging issues that the agency and fish populations face, as well as thinking ahead to future issues for conservation and management in Washington State. What I'm going to do this afternoon is talk about three different research projects that address these areas of current, emerging, and future management needs. With respect to current management, population monitoring is at the core of a lot of the information that we collect. And so really it should be an easy question, right? How many fish are there? What are the numbers of fish? Well, dialing this in a little bit further, one of the main questions that we're struggling with right now to answer is about our hatchery fish. If they're not caught in our fisheries, if they don't return to our hatcheries, where do they go and how are they interacting with wild salmon and steelhead? So many of our hatcheries have both harvest and conservation objectives. It's often fairly easy to know whether we've met our harvest objectives, whether or not the fish are caught in the fishery and how many. Less clear, or sometimes harder to measure, is whether we've met our conservation objectives. So the science questions here are how many hatchery and wild fish return to our rivers, and how much overlap exists between them, how much are they interacting with each other. So I'm going to take you to the Upper Columbia River and show you how we're asking this question in one area of the state. Summer steelhead that return to the Columbia River and are destined for the Upper Columbia end up turning off the main stem into one of four populations, the Wenatchee, the Entiat, the Metau, and the Okanagan. And our science staff are monitoring the numbers of hatchery and wild steelhead that return to these rivers on an annual basis. And we want to know how many fish there are among these populations, as well as among streams within these populations. Some of the streams are specifically supplemented with steelhead to rebuild those runs. Other streams, we don't intend steelhead to be interacting with the wild fish. Well, our old or previous method that we've used to look at this question relies on counts and annual sampling at these main stem dams where you have a mix of populations, and then uses a study from about 15 years ago, a radio telemetry study, to determine where the fish might distribute into the four watersheds. So the problem with this method that we were working with is that the quality, which in science speak we say bias and precision, of the estimate or the numbers of fish was unknown. And so over the last several years, we've been developing a new method. And this new method involves improved tagging and the antenna infrastructure that now exists in the Columbia River Basin. It relies on updated Bayesian analysis methods that now exist for us to conduct the analysis. And because of this, we now have a way of estimating the numbers of wild and hatchery summer steelhead in these rivers where the quality of that estimate is known. We have confidence in the numbers that we are producing. And I'm going to show you in the next few slides how we accomplish this. On the left is a picture of the belly of a steelhead. And this would be an adult steelhead that will be collected at one of the main stem dams, Priest Rapids Dam. At these dams, there are tags, passive integrative transponder tags, that are inserted into the pelvic girdle of the fish. You can see here the needle going into the pelvic girdle. And these tags then are used to track those fish as they return to their natal watersheds. In each of the watersheds, then, we have a series of antenna arrays, and this shows here in this picture on the right, those antenna arrays. Those in-stream arrays are built and they detect the fish, so as a fish swims over it, we electronically can detect that that fish has entered a particular watershed or a particular stream. These antenna arrays, each point here represents an individual antenna array, and you can see that within the four watersheds here, there's quite a network throughout. And in particular, there's an antenna at the mouth of each of these watersheds, so we know whether summer steelhead that were tagged in the main stem dam have entered one of the four watersheds. As well, we know whether they've entered specific tributaries that might be of interest. So putting this together, we have the total counts at the main stem dams, and we use the final spawning locations of these tagged fish to come up with our estimates of wild and hatchery steelhead in these watersheds. And so putting this or comparing these estimates then to what we previously thought was there is important, but then also to know that we now have numbers that we have more confidence in. So this table here shows our estimates for the 2015 spawner escapements of steelhead in these four basins. And you can, this is the estimates from the new methods in the box here. This percentage is a coefficient of variation. It just tells us something about the precision of the estimate. But a few things to note here. We have far more hatchery steelhead in the Wenatchee River than we previously thought. We have far fewer hatchery steelhead in the Entiat than previously thought, and about comparable in the Metau and Okanagan. So in addition now to having a monitoring tool and technique that we have confidence in and that we are now expanding into areas like the Yakima and the Tushi and the Assotin River, we also have information that we can then use to adaptively manage the returns of hatchery and wild steelhead in these rivers. So I'm going to move on then to an emerging issue and away from population monitoring, but you'll see in a moment, to an emerging issue, which I will focus on dam removals, which has several large-scale dam removals currently underway or in process in Washington State. Dam removals allow the recolonization of anadromous fish into waters from which they have been not occupied for sometimes up to a century, but they're also very dynamic, and so requiring adaptive management of the process over time. So we're going to move from the Wenatchee River on the east side to the Elwha River in northwest Washington. And the Elwha River, recently the removal of two dams on the Elwha River has opened 70 miles of habitat, pristine habitat, for anadromous fish to recolonize. The science staff from the Department of Fish and Wildlife have worked collaboratively with federal agencies, as well as the Lower Elwha Klallam Tribe, to develop guidelines for monitoring and adaptively managing the restoration of salmon and steelhead species within the Elwha River. One of the challenges that we face with Chinook salmon is that for 100 years, Chinook salmon had 5 miles of habitat to spawn in the Elwha River. During that time, we developed a hatchery stock that retained the native population genetics, but the science question that we faced when developing these guidelines for monitoring and adaptive management is how do we get from that current state to achieving our long-term goal of healthy and harvestable wild populations in the Elwha River? And so the guidelines set out a series of restoration phases, preservation, recolonization, local adaptation, and viable natural population. And the idea here is that the state of the river would shift for Chinook salmon from a population that was primarily supplemented by hatchery Chinook to a population that was wild, self-sustaining, and harvestable. And we developed a series of metrics that would tell us when we would be moving from one restoration phase to another. And so when we meet a threshold with these metrics or triggers, we would move from one restoration phase to the next, to the next, to the next. Well, where we find ourselves right now is at this transition between the preservation and recolonization phase. So the science staff from the Department of Fish and Wildlife have been working together with our federal agency scientists, as well as the Lower Elwha-Klallam tribe, to monitor and obtain the metrics that we need to determine whether we're ready to make this transition within the within this process. So there are three triggers that would move us from preservation to recolonization in the Elwha, and they have to do with the numbers of fish or the abundance of Chinook salmon, the spatial distribution of Chinook salmon, and the productivity of Chinook salmon. So the monitoring information that we've collected since the dam removal, which began in 2012, show that the abundance of Chinook salmon in the Elwha River has exceeded the recolonization trigger in each year that that we have monitored the population. Looking at the spatial distribution of Chinook salmon, we have seen them spawning above the old Elwha dam site for four consecutive years following the dam removal, again meeting that recolonization trigger of a portion of fish accessing the watershed above Elwha Dam. In 2016, we actually identified Chinook salmon spawning above the old Glines Dam location, which is the upper dam that was removed from the Elwha River. The last metric was productivity. This is the rate at which a population would replace itself from its parent spawners. This table here is a brood table, simply shows that for a given number of parent spawners, these are the number of adults that return. You want a productivity greater than one. You want the population to be replacing itself. So the trigger that has been developed for the Elwha Chinook salmon is that this productivity must exceed one for 4 years following dam removal, so starting with this year here, 2012. So you can see that we haven't had enough years post-dam removal in the Elwha to be able to say we've met this trigger. However, if we look at the productivity in recent years, we can see that we're on a positive track. So kind of putting this together then, what we've learned from the adaptive management guidelines that have been set for the Elwha River and the monitoring that has occurred is that we're moving in a very positive direction toward recovery of Elwha River Chinook salmon. We've met the triggers to move forward with for using abundance and spatial distribution. We are not quite there yet on Chinook salmon productivity. So thinking about salmon recovery and moving forward, thinking ahead, we have dam removals, we have culvert replacements, we have substantial effort to restore habitat. And a lot of our hope for recovery of salmon populations and delisting from the Endangered Species Act is relying on the benefits that will be reaped from these improvements to fish habitat in the rivers, which raises a question: what is the role of fish diversity and habitat in salmon recovery? And that's the last piece of research that I will be presenting this afternoon. Again, I'm going to focus on Chinook salmon because they have very diverse life histories, are a good species to ask this question. And each life history is dependent on specific habitats. So our science question related to this larger question is, how is the habitat and diversity of fish connected to the abundance and the numbers of Chinook that are returning to our rivers? Well, we know from the monitoring that the Department of Fish and Wildlife science staff do in Puget Sound that there's quite a bit of diversity of juvenile Chinook salmon leaving our rivers. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has operated smolt traps at the mouths of Puget Sound rivers for over a decade, and we've learned quite a bit about the juvenile rearing of this species in the process. One of the things we've learned is that most of the Chinook salmon leave our Puget Sound rivers as subyearlings, so within the first year out of the gravel, but they leave over a very extended period of time, starting in January, reaching all the way into the month of August. They also leave in two pulses. So we have fry migrants that go out after immediately emerging from the gravel. They head out and they rear in the estuary, and that estuary rearing is particularly important for this life history. I'll come back to that in a moment. And then there's a second pulse of par migrants that rear in freshwater for 2 to 6 months before leaving to go to the ocean. So we know this about the juvenile life histories. We want to connect it to the extent to which these juvenile life histories are contributing to the numbers of Chinook salmon that return to our rivers as adults. And so to do this, we actually need to reconstruct the growth history of the adult Chinook salmon. Well, fortunately for us, fish leave a record of their growth history, and they leave this record in a small bone that's located inside their skull called an otolith. And this is a cross-section of an otolith here. You can see the tree rings that are sort of daily rings that are laid down as the fish is growing. So that we know that a specific radius of that otolith represents a specific size of the fish, and that's the growth history. But the other really interesting thing that we can determine from this is if we take microchemical information using this laser slice here that you can see through here, we can tell when the fish was this large, was it actually rearing in freshwater or saltwater? In other words, what is the juvenile life history that has contributed to these adults returning to the river? So this is an example of information that we would gain from two different otoliths of adult Chinook salmon. This is would represent the point of fertilization. This would represent the point of the adult returning to the river. A low value here represents rearing in fresh water, a lower strontium-calcium ratio. A high value here represents rearing in the ocean environment. So what you can see in the top fish here is that this fish spent very little time in fresh water, and then it moved to the ocean, it reared in the ocean, and came back as an adult. This was a fry migrant. Now this fish, when we looked at its otolith, it is reared in fresh water for a longer period of time. It went to the ocean, reared in the ocean, and came back as an adult. This fish is a par migrant. So if we look at multiple adult spawners that have returned, we can get a sense of the juvenile life histories, the diversity that has contributed to the numbers of adult Chinook salmon returning to the Puget Sound rivers. And so we're doing this in multiple rivers in Puget Sound, as well as Grays Harbor and the Cowichan River, which is in the Strait of Georgia. This is an example of what we find. So these are results from two different rivers, the Green River on top, the Skagit River on the bottom. A small portion of adults that returned to this river emigrated or went to saltwater as yearlings. And I'm not going to focus on that this afternoon. I'm going to focus on the sub-yearling migrants because that's the majority of what the Puget Sound rivers are producing. You can see that these distributions are very different from each other. And the take-home message here is that the Chinook salmon returning to the Green River, just 1% of those fish had left as fry migrants. Whereas Chinook salmon returning to the Skagit River, 36% of those fish had emigrated as fry migrants. What this is showing is that fry migrant life history, although it's a major component of what goes out of the Green River, isn't surviving to contribute to the numbers of fish returning to the river. Whereas in the Skagit River, quite a few of the fry migrants are returning to survive to adulthood. And we see this across multiple rivers where in the Cedar River, the Puyallup River, the Green River, we see more a pattern like on the top here. In the Skagit River, the Nooksack River, the Cowichan River, we see this pattern down here. And when we think about what is different between these rivers, the conclusion that we come to is that the fry migrant life history, their survival is higher in rivers that have intact estuaries, lower pollution, and have a shorter migration distance to the ocean. So what this is doing is connecting the diversity of the fish with the habitat that's available for them to rear with their survival and the numbers of fish that are returning to the river to spawn, connecting diversity and habitat with abundance fish numbers. So that was a lot of information in a fairly rapid succession, and I just wanted to back out for a moment to talk more broadly about the role of science within the fish program and to support fish management. We think about science and its contribution In terms of current, emerging, and future management issues, clearly there are many, many questions that we face with fish management in Washington State. We think about this with respect to the emerging tools and technologies that are available, as well as science staff are always looking for new ways to analyze new analytical techniques that become available to us over time. This afternoon, I've talked about new methods that we used for Upper Columbia steelhead, which increase our certainty in their population numbers, as well as expanding our options for fishery management. I've talked about adaptive management of the Elwha River recovery, which provide this scientific framework for decision-making at a really historical time in that river's, in the history of that river. And finally, I've talked about the new life history tools, this microchemistry approach to understanding the diversity of Puget Sound Chinook, and how that we're using this to directly inform the recovery and habitat restoration within Puget Sound. And with that, concludes my portion of the presentation, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mara. Yes.
I'm really interested in the methodology and in the population monitoring that you're using. Mm-hmm. Are those radio telemetry tags that are placed in the fish?
They are. No, they're not.
Oh, they're not.
So they are passive integrative transponder, or RFID tags, and so the where radio telemetry tags would be emitting its own signal,
right.
This is actually being detected actively by the antenna arrays as the fish pass over.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes.
That was great.
Interesting.
Great job.